You are about to listen to an episode of The Cypher before it was The Cypher. For our first 75 episodes, we were known as Outside the Lines with Rap Genius, and we had a slightly different format. In all honesty, our production value and sound quality today is much improved from these early episodes. That said, the content is so great that these shows are a valuable part of our archive. If you want more information about our transition, make sure to check out episode 76 with Ritz, which was our first one under the new name. To keep up to date on everything involving The Cypher, visit us online at thecyphershow.com or find us on iTunes. And now, without further ado, here's The Cypher before The Cypher.
One, two, three, four, bam, 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 get up. I'm like, I want to do something like that where I just bring the energy before the beat even drop.
Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. I'm your host, Samuel Chong. This week we have an incredible show for you, one I'm very, very proud to share. But first, we're debuting a new feature this week on Outside the Lines. Every time you hear this sound,
Rap Genius,
go to rapgenius.com and search for Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. The very first result will bring you to annotated interview excerpts, short portions of the show, annotated with extra information, audio, and video to really bring you outside the lines. Now, here's our interview with a man who truly needs no introduction, Big Daddy Kane. Welcome to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. Host Same Old Sean here with the word legend doesn't even really do it justice here with Big Daddy Kane. Thanks for coming by,
man. No, glad to be here, man. Yeah. Glad to be here.
So I wanted to start at the very beginning. Some demos and radio promo stuff I heard of yours that I think even predates the first album, that thing you did for BLS, The Raw Attitude.
Oh, me and Antoinette.
Yeah, yeah.
I could tell you an interesting story about that.
Yeah, please.
Because of Raw Attitude, that's how I ended up getting the music for Young, Gifted, and Black. Like, me and Antoinette was cool, and, you know, Marley asked about doing a promo, and I was like, you know what, I'm going to have Antoinette do it with me. And I made a track over at Marley House, and me and Antoinette, you know, we did, like, that Raw Attitude promo, just talking, because I had Raw, and she had I Got an Attitude. So we called the promo Raw Attitude. And, you know, we did it just for Marley, for the BLS show. Yeah. But Marley took the beat and gave it to MC Shan for his album. Yeah. So afterwards, I'm like, yo, that's my beat. How you just gonna give Shan my beat? I'm like, well, yo, you owe me a beat, homie. And he like, all right, well, we work it. I'm like, no. I already know what I want. Because I had already heard that track, and that was a track that he originally had for Shan. So I was like, no, I already know what I want. That one with the da-da-da. I'm like, yeah, I need that. And that's how I ended up getting Young, Gifted, and Black. Rap Genius.
Even on that song, which that predated your first album, right? That no?
I don't know. It could have. I don't even remember. It could have.
Yeah. But even around that time, like 88, 89 and before, you were doing like the multi-syllable rhyming thing. And that really wasn't super common back then. I was just curious, like, what inspired you to use that technique?
You talking about like, putting a bunch of words that all, like all rhymed? Like,
yeah.
I learned that from Grandmaster Caz, from the Cold Crush brothers. You know, that brother, he was doing that back in 1981. You know, he had some little rhyme he did, like, I just steal the field, make sure it's real. And if you go and get your brother, I won't kneel. Just thrash and bash and get cold cash, smoke hash in a flash, but I don't dash. You know, like, so that's where I really, you know, learned that from Grandmaster Caz and the Cold Crush brothers.
Wow. Yeah, because Ultramagnetic was doing that same kind of style at around the same time as well.
Yeah. Well, they probably learned it from Caz too. You know, I mean, Caz, you know, it's like, you know, lots of times I always say, you know, that hip hop tree. I say, like, you know, Melly Mel birthed KRS-One, and he birthed Tupac. You know, Kumo D birthed Rakim. Rakim birthed Nas. Grandmaster Caz birthed me. I birthed Biggie and Jay. You know.
Definitely. So, speaking of the family tree of hip-hop, on your Twitter account, I noticed a while ago, you made a list of your 5 top MCs and then your 5 top hip-hop artists.
Yeah.
And there was no overlap there, and that really surprised me. What's the difference to you between an MC and a hip-hop artist?
Well, when I say the MC, I'm talking about, you know, the person that just has those lyrical skills. You know, I mean, that don't, you know, MC can also be a party rocker, but because I'm a lyricist, I was really just taking under consideration those with lyrical skills. So that's what I based my top 5 on. And, you know, a lot of tweets that I got, you know, was like, yo, well, how you didn't put Biggie in there? And I mean, you know, I really think that Biggie was a great MC, you know? And I think that those 2 albums that he left us with better than a lot of other rappers' whole catalogs that have made 10, 12 albums. However, you know, due to the fact that he had only done 2 albums, it was hard to really base, you know, like, I mean, put that against artists who've had a long career of great lyrics, you know, like 10, 15 years of just great lyrics, such as Nas, Kool G Rap, you know, myself, Rakim, KRS. You know, so that's why I was basing on, like, who's been, like, ill lyricists for a long period of time. Because there were artists that came before us who, like, were super lyrical in their time, but then their skills diminish. You know, so I was just basing, like, who could still really hold fort and put it down. Now, with the artists, that was totally based on, you know, like, success. And, you know, contributions that you've made thanks to your fame in hip-hop. Mm-hmm. That's how I came up with those 5, you know, because, I mean, like, you take, like, someone like Run DMC, who basically created artists getting endorsement deals. LL, you know, going from clothing line to starring on NCIS. I mean, like, in Jay, I mean, you know, dude part on a NBA team. You know what I'm saying? And Tupac, I mean, you know, I don't think there's another male rapper alive that can say that he got thugged out men walking the street with tattoos of him on them.
Yeah, definitely. There was something that I wondered about on your early records. It was a little unusual to me. You talked a lot about, you know, 5% Gods and Earth's doctrine and a lot of their concepts on those records. But you also gave a ton of shout outs to the Nation of Islam and to Farrakhan. And a lot of artists didn't really, you know, kind of chose one or the other in a way. And I was just curious about kind of your relationship.
I mean, it's all Islam. It's all Islam. You know, I mean, any way you look at it, mm-hmm. it's all Islam. I mean, I don't believe in, you know, separation. I believe in, you know, knowledge of self. You know what I mean? As long as you're doing the knowledge, what you know, and your views, that's how you live your life. You live your life that way, as righteous as you possibly can. And it's not about trying to discredit this division or, you know, what, you know, this division over here feel. I don't operate like that. I have nothing but the utmost respect for Minister Farrakhan and any other form of Islam that anyone practices. You know, I don't condone any of the violence that you have seen by, you know, some, you know, Islamic extremists around the world. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, I'm Islamic, I'm proud of it, and I always will be. And I embrace any Islamic brother from anywhere.
Okay. Would you have considered yourself at any point a member of either of those 2 groups? Or?
Oh, yeah, 5%. That's what when I was young, yeah, that was, you know, my thing. Like, that started, like, around, like, I want to say, like, 81, you know, when I started dealing with all the gods on earth back then. Yeah, that's what I was dealing with. You know, now I just say Islam.
Yeah, excellent. So I was curious about the day you're mine,
about that tune, because I was reading something where you said that Shan's tune, Left Me Lonely, was like a model for that song, right? And you had, I think, even the same producer or whatever, something like that.
Yeah.
Are there any other songs that you worked on where you came in with like a model in mind? Oh, I kind of want to do my spin on this particular song or that particular song.
Yeah. Set It Off. Like, I think about James Brown's Sex Machine, how like you amp before it start, how he just, I'm ready to get into my thing. Moving, grooving, you know, can we count it off? It's like the energy James was bringing. As it's like, you didn't hear the beat drop yet, but you sitting like moving, like you sitting there feeling like Bobby Bird. Yeah, yeah. You know what I'm saying? It's like, and then they, 1, 2, 3, 4, bam, 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 get up. I'm like, I want to do something like that, where I just bring the energy before the beat even drop. So that's why I would Set It Off. You see, just start off just with the rhymes and let it roll, get bold. I just can't. And then the beat, you know, and come in later. Like, I tried to model behind James Brown's Sex Machine. Yeah.
Rap Genius.
Early in your career, you used the word peace a lot, you know, ending songs with it or sometimes rhyming explicitly about it. What did peace mean to you back then?
Obviously, not the same thing it means to a lot of people today, man. I mean, you know, peace is, you know, for one, it's a universal greeting, you know. It can mean, you know, hello. It could mean goodbye. But more importantly, you know, it's a way of life, you know. It's you know, basically living a peaceful life, a righteous life, you know. You know, with love for your, you know, your fellow man, you know, love for your sister, love for your brother, that type of thing.
Excellent. And on each of your first three records, it seems like, you know, I hate this term, but it seems like, for lack of a better term, there are more, an increasing amount of like message records or conscious records or something on each of those albums. What changed that allowed you to kind of talk more as your career went on about like social issues and messages and even gods and earth beliefs and things like that?
Well, I mean, I'm a lyricist, but at the same time, I've always tried to approach my career as an artist. And as an artist, I believe that there's a lot of things that people want to hear. If you're a heavy hip-hop fan, you want to hear lyrics. So I'm going to try to give you that. If you're a woman, you know, may want to hear about love. So I try to give them that. But as, you know, a young generation trying to survive in this world, you need someone that can, A, feel your pain, and B, make you feel like there is something better. There is a way for you to survive, things that you can achieve, you know? So therefore, I try to, you know, deliver some sort of message that, you know, my fan base, I mean, that will touch my fan base, and they feel like, you know, like, yo, he understand what I'm going through, or, yeah, I can dig where he coming from. Yeah, I'm going to do that.
Okay, and did you feel as the records went on that maybe you had a little more pull, a little more weight to kind of talk about this stuff more frequently?
It was just what I wanted to do.
What you were feeling.
You know, I mean, it was, you know, it's it, you know, at that point in time, it wasn't like, you know, the industry now where, you know, you have labels telling you what to talk about, otherwise they're not putting the project out. I mean, you know, Warner Brothers was fair, Cold Chillin' was fair. They let us talk about whatever the hell we wanted to talk about, you know.
Excellent. And one of my favorite message songs of yours is I'll Take You There. And I kind of wanted to get behind that a little bit and see what you're thinking about, why you decided to, like, talk about problems by not talking about them. You know what I mean? By, like, by talking about their absence.
Okay, well, yeah, basically, I'll Take You There, that was really, like, a fantasy record. Like, you know, close your eyes and imagine this place. You know, that's the way, you know, I tried to do it, where I could cover so many different things that was affecting people, and like, just close your eyes and just try to imagine, like, you know, the world being like this. You know, I guess it's more, well, yeah, I mean, it has to be an inspirational song, because the original I'll Take You There, I mean, if you look under genre, You know, it don't say gospel. It says inspirational when you look at Staple Singers. So, yeah, that's basically, it was just an inspirational song. And it also was the first song I did with Marley Marl, too.
Oh.
Yeah. We did that the day that Biz was supposed to record Nobody Beats the Biz. Like, I came there with the lyrics, knocked on the door. Marley was talking to me with the chain on the door. He was like, nah, Biz ain't here. I'm like, well, you remember me? I was here with him the other day. He was like, well, he ain't here. So, you know, I took the train from Brooklyn. I can't, he ain't here. You know, money, I don't know what to tell you. And I was like, all right, man. Well, here's the lyrics he's supposed to do today. Just give them to him. And then that's when he was like, yo, you writing Biz stuff? I'm like, well, I mean, I wrote that. So then he took the chain off. And he's like, you know, yo, how does it go? Can you say it for me? And I said the rhyme. He's like, yeah, come on in. Come on in, you know. And then we got to talk, and he asked me to rhyme. I spit another rhyme for him, and then we worked on a song. And it ended up being I Take You There.
Rap Genius.
That's an amazing story. You've done so much rapping-wise in terms of styles and tricks and things like that that have, you know, people picked up on over the years. And I wanted specifically to talk about one on Warm It Up, Kane. You have that whole line, oh, you know, weak, I meant to say whack, right? And that kind of whole fake mess up thing is now basically like an entire style. You know, people use it all the time. So I was just curious about how you feel when you see stuff like that, things that you did and maybe didn't even think that much of at the time, sort of becoming this sort of entire, almost very established thing.
I mean, I think that's beautiful. I mean, because, you know, I don't mind being, you know, I don't mind being a blueprint. You know, I'm a fan of lyrics. And I try to give good music. And if someone wants to model their career off of something I've done, I think that's beautiful. And I'm also honored at the same time, you know, that you would, you know, choose me as that person, you know. So, I mean, I think that's beautiful. But, I mean, yeah, I don't mind being a blueprint because I want to see you do it right, you know.
Definitely. So there's something I always wondered. Back on the Show and Prove song, there are a couple lines that kind of sound maybe like they're aimed at Eric Sermon a little bit. Did you guys have any kind of little disagreement or back and forth during that era?
Yeah. But we talked afterwards, but by the time we talked, it was too late. The song was already, like, pressed and, you know. But, yeah.
What was behind that? Do you want to...
It was something that he said on a song. You know, someone else came back to me and was like, yo, yeah, I asked him, and he said, yeah, he was talking about you. And I was like, well, let's get the party started then.
Nice.
You know, so I just, you know, I took a cheap shot. And but when I went to go approach him about it, you know, he told me, nah, that's not, you know, what he meant. You know, you're probably the first person to ever ask me that, too.
Rap Genius.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
About the
I don't think no one has ever asked me that, wow. Not even him.
Oh. Hmm. So you did a song with Rudy Ray Moore, and obviously he was sort of performing that as Dolemite. What kind of influence did Dolemite have on you when you were growing up? I feel like I've heard a lot of, I mean, you certainly did do a good impression of him on that song. So I feel like probably not the first time you've imitated him.
Oh, nah. Well, you know, we all love the movies, Dolemite, Human Tornado, Petey Wheatstraw, The Devil's Son-in-Law. You know, we all love the movies. I mean, we used to watch them back to back on the tour bus, you know, to like a VHS would pop, literally, you know. And when Eric B. called me and he was like, yo, guess who I got for my video? He's like, I got Dolemite. I'm like, man, you bullshit. Oh, can I?
What?
Can I curse?
Yes, of course.
I'm like, man, you bullshit. And he's like, no, I got Dolemite. And I'm like, yo, I got to do a song with him. So we worked it out. And Eric flew him in. I paid for his hotel. That morning, he went and did the ghetto video with Eric B. and Rakim. And then came to the studio that afternoon. And we cut the song. Uh-huh. And it was the funniest thing in the world because he was still in character. Like, he still had the Afro wig on and the loud 70s pimp suit.
From the video shoot.
Yeah. And my dancer, Scoob and Scrap, Scoob knew who it was, but Scrap didn't know. So Scrap's sitting there next to me like, yo, you got your grandfather up in here to do a song or something? So I didn't say nothing. I was just like, you see. And then, you know, when I let him up in here, and he just started, you know, you such and such, you know. And Scrap is like, yo, that's the Dolomite dude? And Scrap is like, yo, you got him in the... Like, yeah, he was just losing. And I mean, the type of thing where, like, I don't know how many times the engineer forgot to, like, stop the tape because he was so busy laughing at the stuff he was saying, man. And then, like, you know, just to look, and because, like I said, he's still in character from the Eric B. video. He still had the wig and the loud clothing on, so it was just magic for me. Yeah,
that's amazing. I wanted to ask you, one of my favorite metaphor simile type things you do is, you know, on Mortal Kombat, you know, where you talk about, you know, where it'll be like surgery cutting you open, and you also have that famous line about Ginzu knives. You know, your Ginzu blade, I'm a machete. And so I was just curious if you talk about your idea of, like, your rapping as, like, a knife, as a blade, something like that, if that's kind of something that was running around in your head at all.
You mean, did I feel like that's how I was rapping?
Yeah, do you feel that's how you were rapping? Like, how'd you come up with that image? You know what I mean?
I mean, yeah, that's the way I meant it at that time. I mean, like, you know, with that particular rhyme, yeah. You know, yeah. But, yeah, you know, you'd be up late up in one night and see a Ginzu knife commercial. Oh, that's hot. Put that in, so, you know.
Nice.
That type of thing.
Excellent. You obviously have, you know, lines about martial arts as well. And obviously you took your name from the Kane character and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, like, as a kid, man, you know, like, 3 o'clock Saturday, yeah, in the house, Channel 5. Watch Kung Fu Theater. Sunday, 1 o'clock, in the house, watch Kung Fu Theater. You know, Thursday, 9 o'clock, I think David Carradine Kung Fu used to come on. Oh, yeah, go to the boys' club, you know, to watch Kung Fu movies whenever they had it over, you know, by the Navy Yard. You know, I mean, that was, like, my thing as a kid. Like, just mad fascinated. So, you know, it's like, you know, if I would play with the rest of the kids and jump out of a Coco Livio game or a stickball game because it's about that time for Kung Fu Theater. You know, they had their jokes calling me Bruce Lee or Kane or Young Grasshopper, you know, but I did the Kane thing kind of stuck. I just ran with that one.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
That's awesome. Can you talk, speaking of Kane, can you talk a little bit about creating Warm It Up Kane? Because you produced and rhymed on that one. You produced that as well, right? Can you talk a little about producing that tune?
Oh, well, I mean, I produced a whole bunch of stuff
this
other
is actually,
than that.
Yeah, this is one thing I wanted to ask
get
you.
Get credit that, for it. You
yeah,
know?
That's yeah. Actually, that's one of the things that I wanted to ask you is, like, you've kind of hinted at that before, that maybe you did a little more production work on your early stuff than is commonly thought.
Yeah. It was the type of thing where, you know, at that time, you know, I was young, so I didn't know. I just was going by what I was told. And, you know, basically, like, you know, Raw, Ain't No Half-Steppin', pretty much everything off the first album except for Set It Off. Set It Off was actually done by Mark 45 King, and Marley did I'll Take You There. But, I mean, other than that, pretty much all that stuff is me.
Really?
Know? Yeah. Half-Steppin', Long Live the Kane, Raw, all that stuff is me, you know. I mean, it just rhymed with Biz. We didn't even really do that at Marley House. I did that at my man Shemshon House in LG, Lafayette Gardens, you know, and just brought it to Marley House. But,
And then somehow the credits ended up saying something a little different.
Yeah, see, what I was told was, yo, you know, we got to deal with Warner Brothers because they look at Mr. Magic as the air personality that's going to play any of our songs because he's on the radio, and they look at Marley as the super producer. If they thought that Marley wasn't the super producer, we all lose the deal and none of us would have no label. So, I mean, you know, it need to say produced by Marley Marl. I mean, don't worry, you're going to get your money. And my dumb ass, you know, like 18, 19 years old, I believe that. Okay.
Rap genius.
Yeah.
Wow.
So that's why, you know, like, you know, we became a little legal thing. And then once we worked it out, I was able to put my name on there and I became, you know, got my producer credit. Like, even on that song, I took some shots at him. I said something, like took some cheap shots at the label and at Mr. Magic. What the hell did I say? Something about, so I slowed the juice, so I had to start rushing because I left them to sign with Rush Management. And, you know, Leo used to call all his artists Russians because it was Rush Management.
Yeah.
You know, so I said, slowed the juice, so I had to start rushing. And I said something about Magic, the Raff get tragic. I can't remember, but I, you know, was taking cheap shots at them then, you know, on that song.
Wow, already. It's incredible. So moving forward a little bit on another victory, you know, there was a tune that came out so strongly against drug dealing and that kind of stuff. What was it like for you to see the whole drug kingpin persona start to take over rap, even sort of as early as the mid-90s?
It had its positive and its negative side, you know. You know, the positive side was those were a lot of the tour promoters. And I'm not even going to say that because I might mess a whole lot of people's future up. But those were a lot of the tour promoters. So, it was, you know, we was making a lot of money, you know, because a lot of those cats were booking shows. And also, you know, like, coming to the concerts, you know, because, I mean, cats that was hustling, you know, they go buy, like, 30 tickets for their whole crew so all their whole crew could come, you know, dressed all and everybody got their Dapper Dan outfit on and falling up in it. Like, that was the thing. So, you know, we made a lot of money because of that. But then, you know, of course, the negative side, you know, what it was doing, you know, to people, man, you know. I mean, you know, you're seeing, like, you know, so many crackheads out late at night walking the streets and all that this stuff. And, you know, it was just crazy. It was real crazy. I mean, like it wasn't like, you know, alcoholics or heroin addicts, you know, like, well, you know, you see three or four on a block. I mean, I'm talking about, you know, you might see about 30 people outside fiending, you know, just walking on one block, you know, that type of thing. It was like, that was like a real crazy time.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember who I was talking to, but someone who remembered that era who said that they, you know, literally couldn't even go to the corner store without people hitting them up for...
Yeah. I mean, like I said, it wasn't like, you know, like the heroin era where, you know, you might see two or three, you know, junkies just sitting there leaning, you know. Or, you know, like, you know, the alcoholics, you know, you see a bum on the corner, you know. Nah, this was, like, you know, you see about, they'd be out there, like, 30 deep.
Yeah. So one of the things that I've really admired about your style and your songs is, like, you put, for lack of a better word, positive messages, even into bragging songs, into party songs, rather than just having them being, like, standalone, you know. This is my serious song where I talk about serious stuff, right? Kind of sneak little gems into, you know, like I said, party songs or bragging songs or whatever. Why was that so important to do? Why do that as opposed to just having like two or three songs where you can talk about, you know, serious stuff?
I think one thing I always had a habit of doing is like when I get in my zone when I'm writing and I done said some crazy negative stuff, I try to smooth it out, you know, like, nah, I don't want it to be perceived wrong, so let me bring it back over here.
That's great. And in your debut especially, you have this real lighthearted, fun sense on a bunch of stuff. You know, there's the jokes about peanut butter and this and that, you know, stuff that kind of keeps things light. And I was just wondering if you could, I feel like I hear that in a lot of stuff from that era, and then sometime... You know, somewhere around the mid-90s, I feel like that kind of sense of fun and playfulness sort of disappeared.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you know, by the time of mid-90s, you know, it was gangster rap. You know, I mean, it became where it's like, you know, you as an artist, you know, you standing on stage performing to people that's just sitting there doing this. That was your audience. Like, you look like a clown if you had dancers on stage. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and, you know, you have fine, drop-dead, gorgeous chicks coming up to you talking about, yo, keep it real, son. You know, I mean, it was just everybody was just caught up in this whole gangster thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was really, it pretty much killed the whole party feel. Like, you know, it killed that whole have a good time, have fun. It made it where everybody was just on this here thugged out, grimy, smoke weed, you know, type of thing. You know, and it was dead for a minute. I think Puff was the one who revived it. You know, Puff brought it back because he figured out a way to incorporate the gangster stuff into, like, he had cats spitting gangster lyrics over party disco beats. So he brought the fun and the party back. You know, when you're right, you can hear all the thugged out gangster stuff, but it's over that disco beat that you remember from back in the days. Oh, that was my shit, you know?
And a lot of the sort of fun disco stuff happened at clubs in New York, right, at the LQ and in various places like that when you were starting out.
Well, I mean, no, it goes deeper than the LQ. Yeah. I mean, we talking about Roxy, Danceteria, Roseland, Harlem World. You know, because
I
mean,
because
it's like, you know, when hip hop began, that's what it basically emerged from. You know, the people that was going to disco converted to hip hop. The younger generation, I mean, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like if you was in between, you know, 18 and 25 and you was going to the clubs to hear disco, you started going to like Harlem World, Stardust Ballroom and them type of places to hear hip hop instead, you know. And when you go, it's like you still listen to disco. It's just that there's MCs now.
What would a typical night be like back then at Harlem World, or even later when you started performing at Latin Quarter or something like that?
Oh, Latin Quarters, a typical night, going there, have a few Heinekens and bag a chick. Then when they throw on Ghost Stetsa, you tuck your chain in and stand back in the corner so them Brooklyn niggas could tear the spot up. And go downstairs, get you a gyro, and take the train home.
Nice. So jumping to the present day, you were telling me off camera that you just finished a new record. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, yeah. I united with a soul band here in New York called the Lifted Crew. And my man Showtime that sings with Pharoah March. And we got together to do this thing called The Last Supper. And basically what we did was we combined vintage soul, 60s and 70s soul, with vintage 80s hip hop, you know, over live music. I mean, live drums, live guitar, live everything. I mean, on down to like the glockenspiel, you know, it's all live. And you know, we have like a real nice, you know, soulful project.
Excellent. I can't wait to hear it. Anything else on the horizon?
Me and Premier just did a Michael Jordan commercial for the Jordan 3s. Mm-hmm. You know, because he has like a big February promotion going on. And me and Premier did one of the commercials.
Excellent. That's incredible. Which one of the last things, you know, winding down, I wanted to ask you is you made your list of producers on your Twitter account, they're your favorite ones. And you said Easy Mo B was your favorite.
Oh, yeah.
Which really...
I saw Easy Mo B do something that just blew my mind. Like I still think about that sometimes. Like, when I'm by a drum machine, I still think about that. It's like, I be feeling like, you know, certain producers was here to see what he just did, they would have probably just put their stuff away, man. Just, I don't want to do this no more.
What's a memory of working with him that blew you away?
It was like I brought a record to him that had like this like ill Fender Rhodes roll in it. Like it sounded real eerie, like one of them sounds you hear in Scooby-Doo. You know, it was like real eerie sounding Fender Rhodes sound. And these piano chops, dum, 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 dum. And like, really, that's what I heard. And it was hot. And I'm like, yeah, I want you to flip that. And, you know, he sat there, we chopping it up. He just playing the record. He must have played the record back to back for about 20 minutes, like from beginning to end. And we talking now, you know, we just conversate, but the record's playing. Then he went to work on it. And I don't know how the hell he heard all these parts, but I mean, I watched him chop one bass note, like a bass note, boom. And the cats are doom, doom over here, and this guitar, brown. And like he was just like catching all these here parts. And then when he put this beat together and then was I was just sitting there like, yeah, I've never seen nothing like that. And I mean, I've seen producers chop samples, but what he did, like, I'm like, yo, you are a freak of nature. Like, I don't know how the hell you did that, but thank you. You know, for real.
Awesome. Well, I am honored that you came by. Thank you so much for...
Oh, no, man. My pleasure, man.
Coming
to
hang out. And hope to have you back sometime soon. And yeah. definitely, break down more lines on Rap Genius.
Yeah, we got to do it. We're going to go through some more songs. I'm going to figure out some of my favorite ones, and we go through it, man. Just chop it up.
Excellent. Thank you so much, man.
My man.
All right.
Thanks for listening to Outside the Lines with Rap Genius. The show was created and written by Sean Sotaro, a.k.a. Same Old Sean.
If you're a woman, you know, you may want to hear about love. So I tried to give them that.
The show was produced and engineered by Josh Cross at Crosstown Studios.
Yeah, I don't mind being a blueprint because I want to see you do it right.
The webmaster of the upcoming OutsideTheLines.com is Paul Dice.
I don't know how many times the engineer... forgot to, like, stop the tape because he was so busy laughing at the stuff he was saying, man.
Our show's intern is Sonny Kahara.
And it was the funniest thing in the world because he was still in character. Like, he still had the Afro wig on and the loud 70s pimp suit.
Our theme music is by Psionic.
Grandmaster Caz birthed me. I birthed Biggie and Jay.
And this interview was recorded by Aaron Vasquez.
I mean, you're seeing, like, you know, so many crackheads out late at night walking the streets and all that just stuff. And, you know, it's just crazy.
Join us next week on Outside the Lines when we talk rap, food, and Chinese communism with one of our new favorites, Mayhem Loren. See you then.